And this is Gnostic Media's podcast, episode number 245. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. In episode 245, Dr. Hans Utter returns to continue our investigational series into the history of FM radio titled The Secret History of FM Radio Part 2, Context and Networks, The Radical Left, and Negative Intelligence. This episode was recorded on March 1st and is being released on Saturday, March 5, 2016. Dr. Hans Utter returns to the Gnostic Media Podcast for his 11th time. And of course, we also did the Unspun update with Dr. Utter a few weeks ago, and he's also done 5 RBN radio updates with us for about 17 shows total. And all of those should probably be studied to comprehend all of this information as best as possible. Of course, it's a lot to take in, but well worth your effort. And in the show notes for this episode, there will be 3 articles, including chain links and connectivity of random nets, as well as Dr. Utter's latest article. And I'll also have links for all of his prior episodes with us up on the website for this episode. And because Dr. Utter's been with us so many times, I will limit the introduction. Of course, his website is hansutter.com. And contributions, this episode is brought to you by Jose, Debbie, Oscar, Casey, Gordon, Steve, Thomas, Randy, Marie, Steve, again, who made 3 donations, Patrick, John, Bill, Marty, Lyle, Derek, Hannon, who made 2 donations, Misaki, Stephen, Josh, Tyler, Susan, Hector, Matthew, Willem, Wendy, Barry, Adam, Lewis, Joseph, Tresser, Marie, who made 2 donations, as well as research materials, and Heath, Scott, Barry, Carlos, Jeremy, and Oscar. And we also had an unknown Bitcoin donation. Thanks to all of you for your support for the show and the research and all that we do. Of course, we can't do it without you, so please go to the Gnostic Media website and make a generous donation so that we can continue our research and providing you all of the wonderful content that we do. And this episode is in both audio and video versions. And also, if you're interested, I still have lifetime diamond memberships for Front Sight Firearms Training Institute in Nevada, and I have quite a deal on that. So if you're interested, please contact me directly through the contact form or at contact@gnosticmedia.com, and I'll give you the details on that. And thanks also to those of you who got a membership and helped support the show and also who ordered from the store page, etc. And of course, you can get the books, DVDs, bookmarks, She Who Remembers Archives, the first 7 years of the Gnostic Media Podcast, all sent to you on DVD or jump drive straight to your door. The views expressed by the authors and guests are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself, the host, or Gnostic Media. The website, GnosticMedia.com, GnosticMedia.com. Again, contact me directly at contact@GnosticMedia.com or through the web form on the website. Thanks for listening and thank you for all your support. And here is Dr. Hans Utter for part 2 of our series on the secret history of FM radio, context and networks, the radical left, and negative intelligence. Enjoy. All right, Hans, welcome back to the Gnostic Media Podcast for your 11th or 12th time. I forget now. But anyway, welcome back. We're going to be continuing our new series on the secret history of FM radio. And what was the title or subtitle you'd come up for this episode?
Context and Networks, the Radical Left and Negative Intelligence.
All right. Well, that sounds like a mouthful, so let's fill it out. Where should we begin on this? You want to start off with AM radio and the construction of democracy?
Yes. You know, in order to understand FM radio, it's very important to see this as part of a much broader context. It actually began with the AM radio, and also to understand that there were multiple factions within the government itself working in different directions, some which were working to subvert, to control, to augment or promote certain types of activities. So I think that FM radio, in one level, the massive transformative success in terms of organizing real-time events, in terms of creating a mass movement, or at least being central in that, stems from what went before and also stems from some theoretical bases, which we'll look at. So I wanted to a little bit just talk about AM radio. And when radio came about, it had a tremendous impact on people's lives. And I'm just going to give a quote here from NBC executive Frank Arnold. This is in the mid-30s. And he said, radio is a great family medium, utilizing the very air we breathe, and with electricity as its vehicle, entering the homes of the nation through doors and windows, no matter how tightly barred, and delivering its message audibly through the loudspeaker in the midst of the family circle in moments of relaxation. All right. So just that statement, if you unpack that, notice that, number one, utilizing the very air we breathe. So we have this idea of the life world, right? We'll talk about a little bit about the psychological topology of Kurt Llewellyn, but that's the air we breathe means that we're permeated, right? So the media itself becomes the background or becomes integrated into our lives. But notice how this idea of infiltrating, it's coming through the doors and windows, no matter how tightly barred, right?
And right into the center of the family at the same time when you're relaxing.
Yes. And you can even notice that through the doors and windows also refers to the individual's mind, right? The individual's consciousness, no matter how much they think they're closed off from this message, it's still having an impact, especially when it's linked with entertainment. And just as an aside, talked about the earliest form of mass culture, music culture. These are like, you know, sheet music. This is, you know, going back broadsides. These are obviously from the 40s and 50s, but these are songs played by kids, and these ingrained messages. While they're learning music, they're learning all kinds of different messages that are being inculcated.
And you even read me one that was all about the medicine man in there.
Yeah, it's about the medicine man giving you herbs to chew and herbs to smoke. And that's it. This is for, you know, 4 to 7 year old kids. And that's just another example of going through the doors and windows, right? No matter how tightly barred. Now,
talking about the doors of perception.
Yeah, exactly. And the first person, yeah, actually the doors of perception right there. We have that Huxleyan reference. And the first really successful deployment of the radio, which actually went beyond the expectations of advertisers, corporate agendas, was by FDR, right? So Franklin Delano Roosevelt helped to sell the New Deal through his intimate fireside chats, right? So that's the one thing that you have, is this dissolution of the barriers, right? So you think about, you know, someone, you invite someone into your home, you sit there and they're sitting next to you. Well, that's a very intimate feeling. And by doing that on a mass scale, FDR was able to change and eliminate a lot of the opposition to some of his social programs. And so there's another example, which is this idea of massification or mass culture, right? So we have a shift from more of an individualized nation, even, you know, in the 19th century, but starting with the beginning of this mass media, 1920s, 1930s, we have this development of the concept, and I would say the reality, of the mass mind, the mass culture. And so mass culture serves as a reinforcing mechanism. An example is Amos and Andy. Amos and Andy was one of the most popular radio shows, you know, during the time, in the early days of the of radio, and actually Amos and Andy served to reinforce FDR's political messages. There's a book by Elizabeth Cohen, Making a New Deal, and basically the culture of radio brought together these industrial workers, and they would actually schedule, people would schedule their lives around this Amos and Andy show. But they created a sense of a working, universalized working class experience, right? So they're creating a sense of solidarity with people that are disconnected. And Benedict Anderson mentioned this idea of imagined communities, right? So through the entertainment, the medium is serving to join people in a way that they feel that they're part of this culture and the entertainment, again, where you're relaxed, right? Whether that's at the office, whether it's at home, when you're relaxed, when you're being entertained, is one of the most important vectors, right? Or fields for basically deploying this. And then, of course, in the 1930s, we have Cantrell and Gordon Alport, and their book, The Psychology of Radio, helped to start to codify some of these developments, right? We've discussed that before. But their book in 1935, The Psychology of Radio, went into the effects of radio and also laid out sort of a blueprint or a plan for the continued evolution of that. So according to The Psychology of Radio, quote, by its very nature, radio was a powerful agent of democracy because it penetrated all manner of social, political, and economic barriers. Again, that word penetrated and democracy. And of course, democracy sounds great unless you're living in Syria or Libya where you're having democracy deployed on your country. So we also should understand democracy in this sense. What do they mean by okay, go ahead.
Well, rule by the mob.
Yeah.
And if you can get at everybody, you can control the mob's reaction.
Exactly. At the same time, you're helping to create the mob, right?
Well, the mob is going to be there, but you're helping to create the mob's reaction to whatever you want. You're going back to what was Cass Sunstein and Nudge, right? You know, you're nudging them along constantly in the direction that you want through this mass penetration.
Exactly. And Cantrell and Alport said, quote, radio would be the chief potential bulwark of social solidarity. Bulwark. That is, radio has the potential to be the most important factor in shaping people's social identities and shaping their connection to the political process, to their own particular demographic. So that, and the word bulwark, again, I just want to call everyone's attention to this, the language of penetration, of barriers, of bulwark, right? So we're seeing to a certain extent that this is being theorized in terms of penetrating, but then at the same time, once you've penetrated, to construct a wall around that group. So when we look at FM radio, we see a similar process, right? You create this subgroup and then you create a wall around it where, you know, and that wall serves to instill in-group feelings in people.
Right.
In that.
Well, it's just like the subgenres of music that we discussed in, what was it, part one of Music, Mind Control, and Psychobiology.
Yeah, exactly. And I'll just continue a few more quotes from Mr. Cantrell. People have an opportunity to hear arguments on both sides of current issues. If radio is put to its proper use, it can increase public enlightenment, encourage responsible citizenship, and enhance interest, intelligence, and tolerance among voters. It would allow listeners to expand their mental horizons, allowing the average man to, quote, experiences that the average man has long desired but never obtained, experiences only available to kings, millionaires, and lucky adventurers. So we see again this very happy, flowery language. But Jan, would you want to comment on that? Experience the average man has long desired but never obtained, experiences available to kings, millionaires, and lucky adventurers. So.
Well, you know, it could be taken as a sales pitch as well. But, you know, they're trying to glamorize it and saying it was only for this class, but bringing it en masse to the commoner. What I don't know. There's a few directions you could go to with the underlying theme there.
Well, at the same time, it's constructing this imagined reality, right? So you're taking actual experience, right? I'm an adventurer. I'm traveling to the North Pole. Oh, I'm listening to a radio broadcast. I'm an adventurer traveling to the North Pole, right? The difference with the radio as opposed to, say, a book is that, again, it's a communal listening experience, at least initially, right? But also the imagination, in a sense, it's working to construct sort of an alternative internal universe or internal landscape, right? So you could describe it as a fantasy world. I've already talked about, you know, Lacan and the inner mirror, but you're basically creating this private reality that is shared with all these other people, that these experiences that you're getting, you start to confuse the real and the imagined, at least on a subconscious level. And we can see, of course, this being amplified to the nth degree. And you've probably seen that picture of Zuckerberg walking around in the auditorium with the people with the virtual reality stuff on. Have you seen that?
I don't know if I have. I'll
send you that picture. He's striding like a king, and all the audience members have these virtual reality headsets on. They're all hypnotized masses, you know. So this particular concept is something that's not new, but it's merely been augmented. So at the same time, Allport, Cantrell talk about radio has incalculable power for controlling the actions of men. Okay, so controlling the actions of men. So they're looking at the social use, et cetera, but just wanted to kind of touch on that really the radio really started to be seen as a major political influence, especially with this idea of you're trusting the person you're listening to. And there was a lot of research on what types of voices did people trust, what type of language should people use, what type
you can even get into the whole Ericksonian pacing and all of that too, right?
Exactly. Yes. And so they talked about, they used language of bringing the dispossessed into the radio family. Let's bring the dispossessed into our radio family. Okay. So there's definitely a bit of patronizing, paternalistic language there. But this particular thing was really stressed, especially initially, that radio, another quote from them, would help the poor man escape the confines of his poverty. Radio would be a gigantic and invisible net, which each listener may cast thousands of miles into the sea of human affairs and draw in teeming with palpable delights. So that's very important. The poor man to escape the confines of his poverty, right? So we have this idea of escape, but look at this idea of the gigantic and invisible net. We'll get into network theory in a second here, but this is a gigantic net. They're casting this into the ocean, and the entire sea of human affairs, and they're drawing in palpable delights. So we have this, we are removing people from poverty, or at least mentally removing them from poverty. At the same time, there is this maybe not completely clearly articulate idea, but this idea of creating networks that are influenced by the media, and then that being deployed and moving outward into society. And I think that without being aware of some of these background ideas, I think that we can't really understand the FM radio. But as we'll see in the next segment here, it should be understood that the agenda possibly behind that was not necessarily that of the mainstream, quote unquote, government, certainly not of mainstream American society, but represented a utilization of this and showing its power. And in terms of even as an experiment, or in terms of as simply a deployment of some ideas. I think it succeeded beyond the wildest expectations, in that not only you're suddenly able to look at the entire society or large segments of the society almost as an individual, and then take them through various stages, which should be discussed, right? So it's kind of like you could say trauma-based mind control to a certain extent, or you could just say, mass, large-scale mass influencing. But again, there's a trickle down. It goes into your mind, it shapes how you see the world, and then it trickles out into the people around you and the actual, or even your experience of actual events and people and group contacts in your life.
All right. Shall we dive into pre- and post-war negative intelligence?
Yeah. So I'm going to talk a little bit about this, and we could maybe later go into more detail. But negative intelligence refers, in a sense, to intelligence that's being gathered and being working with domestic populations. So with the creation of the military intelligence section on May 3rd, 1917, Ralph H. Van Denham set up a pretty large-scale organization that was working within America, within organizations, working with groups of volunteers, particular groups of citizens, working to basically infiltrate specific organizations, even creating organizations that people could join. And the primary agendas at this time were anti-German, anti-fascist. There's a lot of anti-communist stuff, infiltrating unions. And this was very much related to, you could say, multiple movements, right? So there were terrorist activities going on. There were a number of radical left organizations at the same time. They worked to remove foreign influences. So it was very powerful in terms of creating anti-German sentiment, in terms of getting people into world wars. But at this time, it's important to know, going back, to the beginning part of the 20th century, there already was deployment of intelligence groups that, again, were working within different subsections, and also, and most importantly, again, working with groups of volunteers and different organizations. And this kind of culminated in something called Emergency Plan White, which was a plan for government takeover in case of civil unrest. So this process of negative intelligence, which was focused on, to a certain extent, on the left, on anti-war sentiment, but also on other types of organizations, shows that not only do we have the deployment of radio, but we also have a growing impact of the government in terms of shaping these movements from the inside, gathering, intelligence on them. And I would believe, even though this sort of became, after World War II, went underground, was not openly discussed, I would posit that there's a possibility that this actually continued later into, even probably into our present day, right? But again, the idea that you can put agents of influence in particular positions and shape the direction of organizations is something that has been around for quite a while. And there's actually an interesting story or novel by Joseph Conrad, The Secret Agent, which talks a lot about anarchism and goes into this in a pretty detailed way, talks about an actual bomb plot where these organizations, were being infiltrated, et cetera. So you don't even know what side is, who's doing what and who's not doing what. And it turns out that the bomb may have actually been set off by the government itself. And this is back in the 1920s.
Sure, of course. Well, and that goes back to, I don't know if I can find it fast enough here, but there's a quote from my article. He says, but that's the way spooks play their games. If there's going to be a social movement against whatever you're doing, it's best if you secretly create and orchestrate that movement against yourself right away so that it never does any unintended damage to your personal fortunes. And that's from the former chief editor of High Times magazine, Stephen Hager.
Yeah.
So talk about controlled opposition.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it's important to note that the tendencies, okay, in the mainstream, so to speak, government or military intelligence, that these techniques, as we'll just see in a second here, when we look at the Pacifica Foundation, were utilized, right, by the anti-war left. And I just want to let everyone know I'm certainly not pro-war in any way, but it's just interesting to see how these things, these techniques are, they have a malleability, they have a movement between these different spaces. But I don't know if a lot of people have thought that this goes back quite a long time. This is not new, but it did morph, and there were some major changes that came about in the early 1950s.
Yeah, well, and we've definitely seen the Pacifica Foundation pop up and their influence from Marxism and promoting the whole CIA's agenda. I definitely recommend people watch part one of this series as well as our series on music, mind control, and psychobiology, because we do expose more of the overlying theme there and underlying theme and the whole music situation, which basically came out of Pacifica and some of the surrounding networks there, but a large part of it was Pacifica, especially KPFA up in Berkeley, who helped promote Alan Watts and the Grateful Dead and that whole thing.
Yeah, and I wanted just to talk a little bit about the founder of Pacifica and his a quote from a letter that he wrote to a man named Finch, who was...
Is this Lewis Hill?
Yeah, and so... Lewis Hill worked with the ACLU. He was an ACLU lawyer during World War II, and he was able to advocate to the FCC to give them an option to do this. And Finch was the one person working on his behalf, and he described that this programming you're trying to do is going to alienate the public. How are you going to get this work? How is this going to work? And this is Hill's response to him. One could hardly deny that the controversial part of our programming will alienate all kinds of people. So what? I think that the rest of the planned program will support the enterprise. And beyond that, it is high time that all kinds of people were alienated by things said over the radio. Even here, though, I am not sure at all about the total effects of our educational programming. And that's in quotes. And we'll see that term come up in a bit when we listen to some stuff from the FM radio series. But back on track. So even here, though, I'm not sure at all about the total effects of our educational programming. We won't have many, if any, one-man commentaries, lectures on how to think. My experience has long ago convinced me that the most effective propaganda can be achieved not by exclusiveness, but by its opposite. An argument is 1,000 times more convincing if it succeeds in the context of its opposite. For this reason, most, if not all, of our ideological programming will be centered in forums and roundtables of the very liveliest and most explosive sort. We'll have everyone on these forums all the time, including the American Legion, etc. What we will depend on is our ability to get participants with the right point of view on the subject who can also out-parry the others. If we follow this program consistently, we will go places. Okay, so right there we have Hill is using the term propaganda, describing their intention of their programming. They're describing how to formulate and direct certain messages. In this case, he's talking about, again, embedding the messages within the context of debates or discussions wherein the viewpoint that is the intention of the propagandist is winning these debates. But at the same time, we can see that this collectivization, right, of argument, so it's not just one person lecturing you or trying to convince you, but the argument itself or the propaganda is embedded right within the stream the largest stream of that. So he very much was talking about, you know, the idea of transforming society, right? So this was very much, this was not something that was a afterthought. This was the fundamental goal of this establishment of this network. In 1951, the Ford Foundation gave him $150,000 for this endeavor. And the whole idea was to create radical institutions that would become parts of people's lives, a lot of times without them knowing it. Okay, so this is, again, going back to the same idea of going through these doors, going through the windows, seeping in, no matter how tightly barred, and integrating people into these institutions without even them knowing that they have become part of this institution, and at the same time creating a wide-scale deployment. So you're not only having, so to speak, virtual networks on the radio, but you have actual people that become engaged in this particular lifestyles.
And for the audience who's not aware, the Ford Foundation also has direct influences from the CIA and OSS. Also funded Margaret Mead. Of course, Margaret Mead was wife to Gregory Bateson, and Gregory Bateson, of course, helped to found the CIA. Ford Foundation was also heavily influencing the foundation of the Tavistock Institute, which, of course, Joe and I have covered recently in numerous episodes. And we see a lot of the Papua New Guinea stuff, Ford Foundation. Anyway, going into some other stuff there, William Stanner. But definitely a lot of overlap between the Ford Foundation and this idea of Native revivalism and using anthropology to usurp society, using the Ford Foundation, the Pacifica Foundation, and KPFK, KPFA, etc., as vehicles for this anthropological system that they were essentially pushing forth via the CIA.
Yeah, no, exactly. And what I think is quite interesting, again, reading his actual words, that he, again, I'll just get another little quote from Hill. There's little doubt that war cannot be prevented through primarily intellectual appeals. The major job for those determined to see a Pacific world in our time is therefore to enter the region close to home, to speak through the newspapers, on the street, and over the radio stations. In short, to identify principles of world understanding where they have direct import in familiar situations. It matters whether the man who writes or works in a shipyard, okay, but as a man first, da-da-da. But again, so this idea of basically, now, again, I am not against, you know, war. I mean, I'm not pro-war, but this idea of, on the newspaper, he critiques this idea of the propagandist, of someone going out and railing at the mass, right? But this idea of bringing people inside and, again, beginning to move society as a whole, or groups of segments of society, towards a particular goal, very subtly shaping them, but not through direct.
Going back to my comment about nudge earlier.
Yeah, exactly. Nudge. This idea of nudging. And then we have this idea of listener supported. So, which is, of course, actually very important in, like, what you're doing. And to a certain extent, what I'm doing is that, you know, we're getting support from the people.
Well, yeah, it's definitely listener supported. You know, we don't have commercials and stuff, you know, and it's like, oh, geez.
But the same thing is that, see, for Hill, he describes this idea of listener supported, even though they're getting foundation support, to give them a sense of democracy, to give them a sense of control, when in fact they may not indeed be in control.
Well, I'm definitely not getting money from the Ford Foundation or Founder Corporation or Public Broadcasting or anything else.
Yeah, but for example, look at NPR these days. I mean, that's actually one of the slickest propaganda outfits going, and I can't even be honest. I used to listen to NPR all the time. I can barely listen to the news on there for a few seconds.
I used to listen to, you know, I grew up in the LA area. I used to listen to KPFK all the time throughout my 20s and into my early 30s, and now I listen to it and it's just completely ghastly and ridiculous. You know, I mean, there is some good and valid information on there. You can't throw out the baby with the bathwater, but I just see through so much of it now.
Yeah. And what's interesting is that when you sort of step out of the mainstream media and come back to it after a period of time, a lot of times it's quite shocking, right? You're like, what's gone on in the past few months? I mean, I've been traveling a lot recently. I was in a hotel room, you know, watching the TV, and I saw some shows. I could literally not believe it. There's a program. It's like complete MK Ultra mind control imagery in this. It's on the Cartoon Network. It's a live action show. I think it's called Birdman. And that show is, have you seen that?
No.
It is so tripped out, and I was aghast and actually shocked this would actually be on TV. You should check it out. It's mind blowing. But it's an example of where you don't watch TV for a while and you turn it on, it becomes amazingly apparent how quickly things have shifted.
Yeah. Well, it's going back to that South Park episode where they're talking about what's his name and the submarine going as low as you go and as you can go. And we showed a little clip of that in one of the prior episodes. You know, they're always shooting for a new low.
But at the same time, if you're embedded in that, it's incremental changes you're not going to notice, right? It's
right,
going to happen.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, and this brings us right to exactly back to our conversation last week in Skype here about Miley Cyrus and her appearing in nude with strap-on dildos and stuff now. I mean, she can't go any lower. You know, it's like...
It's unbelievable that even from when we did over the summer, whenever that was in the fall, we looked at her twerking and suddenly...
She's gone further.
But rapidly, I mean, she's reached the point... I know you got those fashion photographs where she's, you know, she's licking her own armpits and she's doing, I mean, all kinds of stuff.
Masturbating on stage, dildos, strap-ons, all this stuff, you know?
Yeah, and at the same time, there's a whole array of this, you know, mind control, quote-unquote, occult ritual stuff implemented there too. But it's reached a point of, this stuff in even 20 years ago would be considered straight-out pornography. Right,
absolutely.
And but look at her evolution and look at the pace being picked up from her, you know, being this. Actually, I know someone who's related to her from Texas. So he's
so sorry.
Yeah. he said she was really annoying, but he knew. But the way that happened, right, just even me not following the media. And then a few months later, I'm blown away that it's gone to that extreme at that point. And right. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say they're accelerating the degradation for sure.
They certainly are, but at the same time that these particular methods and methodologies are not necessarily new. They're not new at all, but they've in fact been augmented by technology. But at the same time, I think that the rapidity of these transformations is creating massive psychic dislocations that I think people aren't even aware of. Because, you know, if you still believe in any kind of traditional values and your kid has been following Miley Cyrus, you look at the girls. I mean, we're not talking about she's, you know, wearing skimpy clothes or even, you know, sticking her tongue out on stage. We're talking like she's not even porn. She's going into bondage. She's going into the most degraded,
debased,
you know,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, bestiality. I mean, pretty mind-blowing. But anyways. But that same model, what I'm mentioning is that the way of, again, nudging people along, but also not hitting people over the head, but making them identify with the process, and then that relaxation and this idea of the living room where you're relaxed, you trust this voice, and you're allowing this to move you. At a certain point, you're able to experience all these vast riches of the world in your own mind as you sit at home. And that is fundamentally the use of the media in constructing imagined worlds that are actually mass worlds that can be controlled on a mass scale, again, with the possibility of subconscious influence.
All right, let's dig into, where were we? We were at, guess we covered Lewis Hill and Pacifica. Means of social influence, we covered that too, didn't we? Or no, we didn't?
No, I just want to go in a little bit of network theory.
All right.
And so just to let the audience know, we're going to be actually playing a bunch of audio clips. And so I wanted to present this context. And again, this could be elaborated in vastly more detail, but I think that the major sign points are what's important. So in terms of understanding how these things work, right? These processes have been modeled. These are not things that, now, the accuracy of these models can perhaps be debated, but this idea of modeling social influence, modeling social contact through this idea of network theory, network influence, network warfare, and you can look at that in that article I sent you from Global Research. But to show you how far back this goes, I want to just, if you guys don't mind my narration, this is a short story, which is very interesting because this short story actually pretty much describes our world today in some places in pretty mind-blowing arguments. And in fact, this short story has influenced network engineers and people, you know, conceptualizing media and things like that. So this is written in 1929 by a Hungarian author, Figyes Kerinatya. And that may be completely wrong. If it is, you can sue me. All right. So let me just go through this short story. And this is called Chain Links. And just look at some of these keywords. I'll go elaborate a little bit more what this is about. But let me just dive into this. Okay, so again, published in 1929 as a fiction story. We were arguing energetically about whether the world is actually evolving, headed in a particular direction, or whether the entire universe is just a returning rhythms game, a renewal of eternity. There has to be something of crucial importance, I said in the middle of the debate. I just don't know quite how to express it in a new way. I hate repeating myself. Let me put it this way. Planet Earth has never been as tiny as it is now. It has shrunk, relatively speaking, of course, due to the quickening pulse of both physical and verbal communication. This topic has come up before, but we had never framed it quite this way. We never talked about the fact that anyone on Earth, admire anyone's will, can now learn in just a few minutes what I think or do, and what I want to, or what I would like to do. If I want to convince myself of the above fact in a couple of days, I could be hocus pocus where I want to be. Now we live in fairyland. The only slightly disappointing thing about this land is that it is smaller than the real world has ever been. Media, right? Chesterton praised a tiny, intimate, small universe and found it obtuse to portray the cosmos as something very big. I think this idea is peculiar to our age of transportation. While Chesterton rejected technology and evolution, he was finally forced to admit that the fairyland he dreamed of could only come about through the scientific revolution he so vehemently opposed. Everything returns and renews itself. The difference now is that the rate of these returns has increased in both space and time in an unheard of fashion. Now my thoughts can circle the globe in minutes. Entire passages of world history are played out in a couple of years. Something must result from this chain of thoughts, if only I knew what. Maybe I was too close to the truth. It seems as if the same thing happens to our beliefs when we get too close to God. A fascinating game grew out of this discussion. One of us suggested performing the following experiments to prove that the population of the Earth is closer together now than they have ever been. We could select any person from the 1.5 billion inhabitants of the Earth, anyone, anywhere at all. He bet us that using not more than 5 individuals, one of whom is a personal acquaintance, he could contact a selected individual using nothing except a network of personal acquaintances. Okay, so I'll skip through this, but he talks about creating links and eventually using these links to basically transmit ideas globally. Just continue. I proposed a more difficult problem: to find a chain of contacts linking myself with an anonymous riveter at the Ford Motor Company, which I accomplished in 4 steps. And this continues. But then he goes, it gets quite interesting. Is God, after all, more powerful than the devil? He continues on, Aztec tribes. It gets very, very interesting, but he's basically describing this network of influences and also this imagined fairyland, so to speak, this fantasy land, which is what is constructed through the media, clearly described. And in fact, when I talked a little bit about John Lilly, but let me just read the last page of this here. The chain starts with the matter, and the last link leads to me as a source of everything. Well, just like this gentleman who stepped up to my table in the cafe where I'm now writing, he walked up to me and interrupted my thoughts with some trifling and significant problem. Why did he come here and disturb me? The first link, he doesn't think much of people scribbling. The second link, the world doesn't value scribbling as much as it did just a quarter of a century ago. The famous worldview and thoughts that marked the end of the 19th century are to no avail today. Now we disdain the intellect. The third link, this disdain is a source of the hysteria of fear and terror that grips world today. And so to the fourth link, the order of the world has been destroyed. Well then, let a new world order appear. Let the new Messiah of the world come. Let the God of the universe show himself once more throughout the burning rose-hip bush. Let there be peace. Let there be war. Let there be revolution so that, and here is the fifth link, it cannot happen again that someone should dare disturb me when I am at play, when I set free the phantoms of my imagination, when I think. So I skipped through that, but he's talking about so many concepts, the growth of these networks, reducing the world to ashes. He even talks about, and this is 1919. This was written in like 1918. There was very limited telephone, radio was just, being born. This is very prescient. You have any thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, there was a couple, but it reminded me of something. I'll have to think about it later. But anyway, I didn't want to interrupt you, and I didn't write it down. So,
yeah, well, but what we see here in this quote unquote story is this idea of these network analysis. Okay, again, written as a short story, and it contains many different ideas. It's this mind game of five links, which ultimately leads to the destruction of the world that we know. But at the same time, it leads back to the individual. This guy is a source of everything. So in a sense, he has this solipsistic notion that everything is leading back to him, which is sort of like the ideal self, the constructed self of the consumer of mass culture. They see themselves as the center point. The fairyland, right? So not only is this describing, in a sense, these computer networks, it's describing information technology, it's describing television, it's describing radio, but it's also describing the means to an end. And let me state also that this, I found the short story in a quote-unquote book on mathematical theories of network with rigorous mathematics going through how networks are calculated, how to do all these formula, different types of equations, and that's from that book. This is not from a science fiction anthology. So as a centerpiece, I think, of the thinking and to see how far back it goes, because I also talked about the military intelligence section being formulated in 1917. Not that that's coincidence, but I mean, just that, let the new world order appear, let the new Messiah of the world come, let there be peace, let there be war, let there be revolutions.
Well, and that's the whole transhumanist philosophy, Ray Kurzweil and Google and all of them. That's what they're attempting to do with all of this.
Exactly. And so just a little bit about like network theory. Network theory is based on sort of mapping multiple vectors. So you're not looking at a single linear process, but you're actually mapping different segments, different nodal points with different types of influencing mechanism, including, say, for example, a radio being deployed in a particular community and particular social configurations and how that'll work. So there's an article from 1951 by Ray Solomoff and Anatole Rapoport, Connectivity of Random Nets, right? And this is kind of refers to how, for example, we have the FM radio as arising as a type of a random network that's being sent out across this terrain, also the topology, the psychological topology, right? So we have this connectivity, and how are these influences going to generate? What kind of resultant factors will come from deployment of particular types of influence on particular types of audiences, right? And so if you look at what Lewis Hill was talking about, some other things I mentioned is that you give this idea that people are in control. This is grassroots. We're doing this ourselves. We're part of it. That gives this investment of the listener, of the participant, to this particular scenario. And, you know, what we see, I mean, and we can get in this, you know, in later episodes, but I talked about how radio was used to create mass gatherings, to create revolutionary protests, to literally go from the virtual realm, to go from this speculative realm, to go from audio waves that people are listening to mass public action and getting people all across the country to identify with, you may be in a small town somewhere, you know, in Wyoming, but you're identified with the hippie movement. Right. You've identified with these things. And this is an example of these network type of connectivity. And then I'm not going to get into the mathematics. I mean, it's a little bit beyond my ken here, but it's, you know.
And what was that citation again? Make sure you send that to me so I can put it on the screen.
And another example is contact and influence. Okay. And this is contact and influence, which is basically was described in that short story, so to speak. And this is how a mapping of the field of human network studies, how particular types of contacts and influences are deployed. That is, a type of contact can come via the media from a personal source. How does this influence ripple out to the community? What type of effects does it have? How does it start to transform the society as a whole? And I'm not going to go into all the details of that, but suffice it to say here is that what I kind of ascertain as I'm going to the FM radio is this whole color revolution model. All these things being deployed are really utilizing some of this actual models developed in the deployment or the organic growth of FM radio, right? And these are being used in color revolutions. These are being used all over the world. And so this is not something that's abstract, but it's something that is very real. And again, there is scientific data, and there's ways that these things are mathematically modeled as well as psychologically modeled. And then just as a last point on this direction, Kurt Lewin, Principles of Topological Psychology. And this basically serves as, and this is written in 1936. So this topological psychology, this allows, in a sense, okay, let me just try to break this down a bit. If we look at, okay, we have a medium of technology. In this case, we have the radio. The second thing, we have a particular audience segment. We have particular social economic conditions. We have another tier, which is a psychological environment that's inhabited by these people, right? So there's a sense, there's a psychological space. There's an individual psychological space. There's a shared psychological space. Right. So this topology allows this deployment of networks, both conceptualized as physical networks of contacts, but also influence, networks of influence. So, and I think that as we listen to some of these direct quotes from FM radio insiders, all this maybe what seems like abstract conceptual terminology, I think will be very much clarified.
And just a little quick background on Kurt Lewin. He was at MIT, heavy Zionist, also at Cornell University. He was a big eugenicist. He was pals with B.F. Skinner, Eric Trist, whom, of course, we've covered multiple times recently with Joe, who was the founder of the Tavistock Institute. Kurt Lewin was also one of the key founders of the Tavistock Institute. He also worked with Norbert Wiener and worked with Project MKUltra and was a key figure of the CIA's Macy conferences that were behind Project MKUltra.
Yeah. So, you know, the one thing is that, you know, these, whether or not, okay, let's take hypothesis A, that this is random, organic, just came up. But even if that's the case, certainly this stuff was researched theoretically on a pretty deep level, right? And continues to be researched.
Right.
And the fact that this...
Well, the most frightening thing, Hans, is that this was researched 70 years ago, and you and I are just getting this stuff out to the public now. I mean, has anybody else even tried to lay this out for the public that you're aware of?
Not that I know of. And as I think I mentioned in the beginning of the interview, or maybe when we're talking, as I was doing this research, I was shocked to find that a lot of these books are just extremely hard to find. They've been taken off
the library shelves, right?
Yeah, and this is Ohio State University, one of the largest universities in America, you know, with one of the best libraries. And I'm going, none of these books are available, or I need special permission. Why is stuff on FM radio? Okay, I understand it may not be on the shelf, but why are these books, you know, three or four different hoops? I have to go, one of these books, I have to go and personally prove to the prove to the administrative desk that they'll allow me to get this book. It says, go, please see desk and describe your reasons for wanting this book.
What you're describing is exactly like what Gordon Wasson's daughter, Masha, required of me trying to gain access to the Wasson archives at Harvard. Was they wanted me to say what I wanted to see and what I was going to do with it before I saw it.
Yeah. And as I was, you know, like I'm saying, just even looking up Jim Ladd stuff or all this stuff, and a lot of this stuff was actually, some of these things were in the law library, which I have to travel around, but why is all this stuff in the law library or in the rare book collection, and why has this been moved into the book depository? And I was really surprised as they've got, hundreds of books on, you know, Arcane, the invention of the sewing machine, and there's nothing on the shelf on FM radio. I'm like, you know what I mean? I'm like, okay, I like sewing machines and all, but I mean, you know. So, but you know,
it's like one of the most important, you know, and of course the sewing machine is a hugely important invention too. I mean, we're all wearing stuff as a result of it, but you know, it's the FM radio is such a huge impact on our society and in a system of forming and manufacturing culture that the lack of information out there is extremely telling.
Yeah. And again, I've done lots of research. I've done some pretty arcane subjects. And yeah, occasionally I have to order some, you know, but you know, even I can find, you know, books in Arabic or books on obscure things. Occasionally, you know, some out of print book I'll have to order from interlibrary loan. But the difference is this. I got a book from the Garhwal Himalayas. It's a very rare book. I have to order it. But all these books are in the collection, but they've all been removed. They're all hidden. So it's actually easier for me to order it, say, on, you know, OhioLINK or WorldCat, than it is for me to go to these archives. And again, it's telling there's a huge chunk missing. There's a lot of stuff on AM radio. There's a lot of stuff on, you know, the early media. But then there's this huge gap, and that's what I think is of most interest to me, that I think by actually, Jan, you giving me this really pretty amazing series of Jim Ladd is I think that we're going to continue to uncover a variety of important historical and contemporary influences.
Yeah, and why it's so important, and, you know, and just in my own case, researching that Jim Ladd series and trying to get a hold of Part 6, I mean, you know, where the hell is part six, and why is the only copy of part six at Harvard University? The only, that's the only place. And well, there you go. So now you have a job to do.
I'm going there on Friday, so I'm going to go ahead and look there, for that.
Now you've got a job to do. So, yeah. Let's see if you can find part six. I mean, because that'll fill in the gaps. And every single copy that other people have sent me online that they've tracked down, et cetera, everything is missing part six. And the version that Jim Ladd played, the version that KPFK played, Roy of Hollywood, I think, played it years later, they're all missing part six. And supposedly that tape was just ripped up and thrown away or some nonsense, but.
I noticed through going through that series is that as you go on, the revelations become more and more intense, right? I mean, what's happening becomes more and more kind of in your face or sometimes subtly, right? And a lot of times you do have to read between the lines.
For sure.
And some of it, you know, you get into this. I mean, the narrative that's being described is, you could say the overarching narrative is, you know, our great generation and then the loss of the freeform radio into the corporatized, FM playlist of the 70s and 80s. But at the same time, there's some very interesting stuff about what happened at the end in a mass culture, how, you know, describing almost this wasteland of communities with all these like strung out hippies, with just the entire movement really had a devastating effect. And this happened in a few short years, as that short story described, that, you know, huge parts of historical movements will be condensed into periods of just several years. And I think that's what we see, with the 1960s is this mass effect on culture. And the fact that I think that what we're seeing today is really a continuation of that. I think that that's why, well, let me not say that I think that's why, but that's a possible reason why this has been sort of ignored. Who cares about FM radio, man? It's of the past. Everyone's, you know, World Wide Web, we're streaming, we got virtual reality, we got smartphones. But anyways,
smartphones and dumb people.
Yeah. So on that note, do you want to go ahead and go into some of these clips?
Or would
Absolutely.
You like
to, this is, okay. So, let me just, you want me to play them?
Or
you
sure. Want to play them? Yeah, you can go ahead and play them and I'll edit them in the final cut. So go ahead.
Okay. All right. I just bring out my file here. But actually what's interesting is that because of not being able to get the files that I want, I got into all this other stuff, which I probably wouldn't have known about, right? The much earlier, deployment. So may have backfired, right? And I'll just kind of go through just in order here as they are in the playlist. So, okay. So I'll just play it. You want to comment on it, whatever.
And then go ahead and let's.
Okay. So here we go. Okay, clip one.
B. Mitchell Reed.
We knew we were educating. We knew we were being great educators. We knew as that stone in the water, as the ripples went out, we were going to get to a point where people were becoming to us, but not necessarily understanding where we were coming from and wanting to get behind it and wanting to understand it.
So now you're talking about educating people musically.
Yes.
Educating them to social events.
Right.
Getting them to look at themselves.
Right.
And all of this is going on just because of FM radio.
FM radio. And, of course, having we had our Dr. Demettos in those days. It wasn't a Dr. Demetto. We had those off-the-wall people who would walk with an idea. We had, we'd give them time. We'd give the yoga people time. We'd give, anything that was a mind-expanding thing. As long as it was a mind-expanding thing and interesting at the same time, man, the health food people would have their time on the air. You know, sure, do what you want to do. You got an hour on Sunday. You got a couple of hours on Sunday. Do what you want to do. You know, sure, bring in Timothy Leary. Right, put him on the air.
The LSD trip is a pilgrimage far out beyond your normal mind into that risky and revelatory territory which has been explored for thousands of years by mystics and visionary philosophers. In the last year, we are told that perhaps 1 million Americans, most of them young people, have made the LSD experience part of their lives.
You can.
Okay.
I think we.
Yeah, we would.
I think we played a little clip of Larry there at the end with the Moody Blues in the background. But yeah, that's very telling there.
Well, do you notice? Let me just bring a couple of points up. Is number one, the idea of educating. We could even listen to that again. The idea of we're there to educate the audience.
Right.
They don't even know why they're coming to us. We're educating them. And then going back to the 1930s, the poor man can become a millionaire. The poor man can become a great explorer. The poor man can travel these horizons. Exactly what Leary is saying, is it not? So we see a direct tie-in with this idea of, and going back to that science, quote-unquote science fiction story, the fairyland, right? We see a direct tie-in with this deployment of the media, do we not?
Well, that reminded me of Adventures with the Poor Man. What was his name? The DJ from K-Rock in Los Angeles. There was a whole series on like Channel 56 or something like that. Jim Trenton, the poor man. So, yeah, I mean.
Yeah, the great democratizing agent. I'm going to go through. There's another quote from B. Mitchell Reed. It may be at the end of this Leary thing. So let me just.
All right.
Fast forward. I think I clipped that out, but let me see if I. Okay. Okay. So we can cut that out. But that Leary thing is great because. But what's also very interesting about the Jim Ladd thing is even the music examples and what he plays, there's like multiple tiers of meaning, right? So he's talking about educating, they play this Leary thing, and that's like an infomercial, right? But so much of what I just discussed earlier is being expressed directly how it's being deployed. So let me just go ahead and play another clip here.
Sure.
Because the incredible media consciousness that's present now. People know more about what goes on inside radio and television movies than they really need to know. That's okay. As long as we're honest with them, it's okay. They're so media aware. They know who plays the most Beatles and the least Stones. They know who talks the most, who talks the least. They know who's hard, who's soft. They know more about our stations than we do.
Okay. One thing there. They know more about the media than they should know. Okay. Just that little snippet, but people know too much. They know too much than they should about what's going on in the media world. At the same time, it's okay if you're honest, right? But that's, again, that DJ who's a man, you know, the way he expressed it, you know, you get a little bit of sense of this patronizing attitude. But the fact is, hey, let us do our things behind the scenes. You don't need to know why we're doing this. Right? The same thing. They're coming to us for education. Let us educate them. Let us deploy this education. Let us give all these, this democratic world and allow people to live in this fairyland of these interconnected networks. Right. I don't know if you want to
say anything about that. Nah, well, let's just dive right into the next one. These are
okay.
Good.
So this is Elliot Mintz.
I ask Elliot Mintz
why the jocks were so proud of this. Someone once wrote, "To live beyond the law, you must be honest." Bob Dylan. That's a wonderful line from one of his songs. And it's true that when you're really a renegade, when you're really an outlaw, and I'm talking about being a verbal outlaw and an outlaw of ideas here, not in terms of robbing banks, but when you're really out there on the edge, you don't have any conception of the thought that you're an outlaw. You feel that you're an innocent. Because you actually think that your ideals are a confrontation with a corrupt society. So you've got them pegged as the outlaws. That they're the ones who are exploiting everybody and taking advantage of everybody and buying everybody off and bulldozing the forests. And they're the ones who are paving paradise and putting up parking lots.
Okay.
And meanwhile, these guys are working for the intelligence community, pretending like they're on the fringe of this alternative thing, right?
Yeah. Well, this idea of the outlaw was very much articulated by Lewis Hill, is that we want to take the alienated, angry outsider. And
this year, I think they've remarketed it to Rebel Hans, just so you're aware of the latest.
Oh, okay. Rebel.
Right.
Well, this was discussed even in the 40s by Lewis Hill, and saying that, you know, we want people to sort of identify with this radical, angry, viewpoint, which would normally be that is on the fringe of society, right? It's almost like the guy on the soapbox, and he uses that as an example of unsuccessful propaganda, the guy rallying people on the soapbox, but they actually want to inculcate this alienated position within people. As they mentioned, people don't even notice that they're outlaws. They see the society as an outlaw. So you see a clear description of this in-group, out-group bifurcation, as well as through the educational process, people beginning to identify themselves and taking that as a normal worldview without necessarily even being aware that that's happened. So, okay, I'll keep going. Here's Greg Lake from the wonderful band Emerson, Lake & Palmer. And one thing about them, they were quite a good group, but they have one album called Love Beach, which is one of the worst albums of all time. You might have seen that. They're wearing Speedo bathing suits. They were repackaged as a pop band. It was a major marketing fail. But anyways, so Greg Lake's probably a little bitter, but he's talking about radio's influence on audience here.
Of Emerson, Lake & Palmer.
They'll only ever get to hear what the media exposes. That's the problem. That's the whole problem. It's true that FM does play a lot more broadly based music. But from my position, it would seem as though FM radio is being swayed more and more towards the middle as time goes on. You can't escape the fact that, you know, if you hear 9 records out of every 10 you hear have a certain type of coloration, you'll start to relate to that as music that you're used to and music that you like, if you like commercial music. I'm not necessarily saying that the media is influencing the people badly. It's just the fact that it does influence them.
There was.
I'm not necessarily saying that.
Yeah.
I'm saying it, but just not necessarily.
So, Greg Lake, you know, again, as sort of an insider / outsider, you know, someone who they were pretty popular, and then their band fell into, you know, became marginalized. They used to play like the Ohio State Fair, you know, at the tent. They went from big rock stars. They're playing and the guys are having, you know, the heifer contest, you know, and then Emerson, Lake & Palmer is playing there, you know, guys on their tractors. And then they're doing, welcome back, my friend, to the show that never ends. But come inside, you know. On Love Beach, that kind of shows. Just give an example. You might want to bring up that cover. It's an example of how this group, they may have gotten too much knowledge. They may have been a little bit too intellectual, and they were also marginalized to a certain extent. But what he's saying there, just to pull that apart a bit. Number one, we go back to Theodore Adorno, Princeton Radio Project. This idea that popularity can be created by repetition, that the popular music will become popular by default because people keep hearing it. So there's a psychological mechanism that when something is familiar, right, you have something that's repeated, becomes familiar. Oh, I like that. I like that.
So Casey and what was the other guy?
Casey Kasem and, yeah, Mad Wolf, whatever.
Yeah, there was another guy too. Geez, now I can't think of his name. But basically, these guys weren't reporting what was at the top of the charts by natural progression, but what they repeated the most and put at the top of the charts.
Exactly. And the Princeton Radio Project did serve to really outline this, and it's served to create, you know, our contemporary environment. But if you do look at the freeform radio as, in a sense, as a gathering for all these people that are sort of disaffected, certain types of people that are more perhaps exploratory, more whatever, and bringing them into a group, and then you progressively shift them, right? So you go through the corporate rock, the mass media, et cetera, and the coloration, right? So in a sense, it influences even your ability to understand what is there, what is good, what is bad, because there's another subtle psychological factor that goes with the mass media, is that when you hear something by repetition, just as sort of an innate survival mechanism, say, for example, you're living, you know, with a tribe, and there's certain social mores, there's certain things that are part of that tribe that if you violate those terms, you could maybe be executed, you could whatever. So it relates to a sense of social solidarity. It also relates to the fact that we tend to, the more things that we can offload in sort of unconscious habitual processes, it sort of frees up the mind. So that's also sort of a survival mechanism. So there is a utilization, again, of both of interpersonal dynamics, the fact of this repetition of the identification with the group, and even, again, on deeper sort of an evolutionary standpoint of aligning yourself with what is going on in your particular tribe, so to speak, so that you don't become thrown out to, you know, die and live with the wild dogs in the wilderness. So let's move on.
Excommunicated.
Exactly. So that's all these factors are there. And, you know, Greg Lake does say, you know, it colors the colors. So we can break that down more, but we'll just continue here. Next right. one.
That there was a movement afoot during the Nixon administrations to squelch this because we were threatening a money-making proposition, and they were very afraid. They planted some people in various places to really get things pretty snarled up among the people that they thought were behind all this. And they kept looking for conspiracies and couldn't find any because there weren't. You know, they kept looking for the commies in there or something. Who knows, man? Them guys was nuds.
So that talk about one big appeal to ridicule there. Wow. Let's ignore all the facts and evidence. We're just going to really ridicule them and call them nutso.
Yeah, I think that's one of the guys. I think that's David Crosby. You can tell he's definitely been lighting up. And in fact, Jim Ladd does suggest at the very beginning of the series to go ahead and light up a joint. And so there's.
Well, yeah. I started with Jim Ladd saying that in the last episode, you know.
But. I think that's an interesting quote there because he does talk about infiltration. He talks about people being planted at significant portions, which goes back to that military intelligence section, which I talked about going back to the 1920s. So you do have movements and counter movements within both the government, but sometimes they can be working together. But then he mocks the idea, oh, there's no conspiracy. They thought there was some communist conspiracy going on. But this idea of infiltrators, you know, anyways, we can let the audience, if they've been following this, they probably have some ideas of agents of influence being placed at key points in certain important junctures of the countercultural history.
You mean like Agent Timothy Leary?
No, that's a conspiracy.
Yeah. Even though he admitted it himself, and he admitted it with Walter Board, who was... the husband of Mellon banking heiress Peggy Mellon Hitchcock.
you guys gotta take some clean LSD and smoke a joint and just chill
yeah.
out, man.
Yeah, give me some of Billy Hitchcock and Owsley Stanley's LSD.
Just as an aside, I saw a pretty interesting article about this girl. Well, she's some kind of college student, you know, I was doing a PhD or something, and she took ecstasy, and then she had these she started to have a permanent hallucinations, and then she's saying she ended up getting eye surgery, but she basically just describes it as a good thing. But she does throw in there, even though LSD use, hallucinogen use in the early 20s has been linked with the development of schizophrenia, but she ends up kind of spinning and saying, well, it's really awesome that even though I was like kind of in a permanent hallucination for a year, I really, you know, really got all this love and everything. So it's really interesting how that, you know, the backspin and counterspin, notice embedding an argument within a field of supposed dissent. Going back to Lewis Hill, you have, it looks like you're having both sides of the story, but you're actually propagating one viewpoint and rendering that argument more powerful.
Well, and that's exactly what my article in Theogen's What's in a Name, The Untold History of Psychedelic Spirituality, Social Control, and the CIA exposes. And that's essentially what my purpose of writing it was to expose how, you know, they've sold schizophrenia or psychosis as a spiritual experience. You know, the psychotic break is sold as spiritual. And you know, when the drugs were called psychotomimetics or schizophrenogens, nobody wanted to take them, so they just renamed it.
Yeah, but you know, again, I just find it really fascinating. You know, again, this story, chain links, 1919. Now we live in fairyland. The only slightly disappointing thing about this land is that it's smaller than the real world has ever been. This idea of this virtual world, same thing. I mean, it's really interesting that this mapping of the psychological space with the real-time, real-world media, technological, social, economic mapping with different organizations is being simultaneously deployed. Which creates quite complex systems. Anyways, let's go ahead and move on. Next section.
For the radio, in such a mass way, based on things that had nothing to do with music. And that's when the media revolution had to step back and analyze its own personal motives and the motives of all the newcomers who had joined the ranks, plus had to analyze the desires of the audience that they were bringing their messages to. That was a major turning point. And I think that can be traced to Grand Funk. I think they were the first of the no-nos, of the groups that it became very uncool to like.
Okay. I'm just gonna play the beginning of that real quick. Some of this stuff is just hidden in there. This is Elliot Mintz again. Let's play the beginning real quick.
For the radio, in such a mass way, based on things that had nothing to do with music. And that's when the media revolution had to step back.
Media revolution. Revolution, things that had nothing to do with music.
Had to step back.
Yeah, and this is a revamp, next stage. Okay, I'll just continue here. And this is, again, this is Elliot Mintz.
Okay, so this is what, social consciousness?
Yep.
They're the ones who were paving paradise and putting up parking lots. And anything that you say, and almost anything you do that's a contradiction to that, is certainly not an act of vandalism. It's certainly not you being an outlaw. But it's a very straight, socially conscious position.
Okay, so this idea that, again, inculcating these radical tendencies or belief systems, and it's, you know, again, there's a lot of laudable things, right? The anti-war movement, which my dad was a part of at Berkeley, was guys wearing ties, you know, before the hippie movement came, right? So it's not that there's anything wrong with preserving your environment, but the way that it's inculcated, and again, taking this radical position and moving that to the center of people's consciousness. Okay, let me just keep playing here. And this is pretty interesting when he talks about the decline and what happened. So again, look at this period of 3 years. You almost have an entire social evolution compressed into such a small time. And the reverberations of that period, again, are it massively transformed, I would say, not only American culture, but world culture. So,
around 1971, America was in very bad shape. Nixon was about to engage in his second term in office. The Vietnam War was in full swing. Bomb Hanoi on a Sunday, aim for the kids, you know. It just seemed futile. I would assume that somewhere around here, the students would have been killed in Ohio by the National Guardsmen. There was a general selling out in terms of the music. There was a kind of feeling in America in terms of the alternative culture of life kind of being futile. The dream that started around Haight-Ashbury had burned out. What started with acid was really ending up with Bad Speed and Horse. And already you were beginning to see a whole culture of teenage degenerates. I mean, people who were just wasted, who were sick, people who were ODing. And every week you'd hear something over the telephone about another friend of yours who took bad smack or whose needle was dirty or, I mean, it got ugly. In a period of 6 or 7 years, the dream had virtually turned into a nightmare. Now, I know a lot of politicos have their own reasons and conspiratorial theories as to why that happened or how that happened. We're not here to engage in that. We're talking about FM radio. I think FM radio started to get dirty around that time, too.
What do you mean by dirty?
Well, it was apparent to the operators of radio stations that this game was the way to bring in the bucks. You want to get the kids, you just play that airplane, you just play that dead, and you can sell them virtually anything. And there were pretenders to the throne. Now there were disc jockeys who had no ear towards the tribal drum, but simply to the tribal money and the tribal greed who were getting on the air. I think the last of alternative FM radio, as I knew it and as I perceived it, ended around 1971 with KPPC. And I guess for me too, on a personal level, it ended. I kind of felt that the dream had been fragmented, and I no longer heard the sound.
Well, you know, that reminds me of this quote from Walter Boart in his book. I think it's from his book, Operation Mind Control. But he creates this bogus story of LSD and the government and how the government shut down the psychedelic revolution. Which I expose, this is from my article, Spies in Academic Clothing, which if you haven't read it, you should. But he says, it did this by controlling the availability and quality of drugs. Underground LSD labs were raided, and it wasn't long before its quality degenerated and the supply dried up. Several studies have shown that when LSD became illegal, real LSD ceased to be available on the street. It was sold as LSD. What was sold as LSD was every other kind of chemical, including several forms of veterinary tranquilizers. Often, methadrine was sold as LSD, as well as heroin mixed with amphetamines. Simultaneously, as the LSD supply dried up, large supplies of heroin mysteriously became available. It was strong heroin, imported from the Golden Triangle in Southeast Asia, largely under control of the CIA. Many young people who had their consciousness expanded too far to distinguish between one kind and another turned to heroin. The government inspired hysteria over drugs. Government inspired hysteria, note that, had led many to think, well, they lied to us about pot, they must be lying to us about heroin. And so when psychedelics were no longer easily obtained, and heroin was, many people became addicts. And then I just go on to state there, Boart describes how the government shut down the psychedelic revolution. However, it is well understood that children do not rebel with legal substances and that LSD had to be outlawed as well as remarketed in order to launch the psychedelic movement.
Wow. And that is exactly what Elliot Mintz is saying. At the beginning, first episode, he talks about the tribal drum, the tribal consciousness, right? At the same time, he very clearly, he says human wrecks, human wastage, okay? And this movement, you can see just as someone is led through a process of cult indoctrination, you get there, then you have a breakdown, a shattering of the personality, right?
Right, absolutely.
You have this futility, hopelessness. So you're led from these grand dreams. We can change the world. What, dude, 3 years later, it's all gone? What happened? And he's talking, this doesn't have any place here. This conspiracy BS doesn't have any place here. This is about FM radio.
Right.
But even notice the operators of the station of that. So let's move on here.
Yep.
And this can be parsed a lot more, but I think it's interesting to hear this in these own guys' words. And again, you can do a lot more analysis of
this
how
this is. This one's Radio is Madness.
Yep. Radio and Madness. Yep.
Hey, am I going to be in this show, Lab?
Bonnie Simmons.
I mean, I don't think it's just radio that's like that. I think most people are stark raving mad. A lot of people hypothesize that it was food additives that has done most of this to us.
Uh-huh.
There are others, of course, who think that it was psychedelics. Of course, but talented people are a little bit different. I think that ultimately the people that I work with are the sanest group of people I know. They may all have certain little idiosyncrasies that make them totally unemployable anywhere else. But at KSAN, it all seems to work quite well. I trust them all pretty much with my life. Oh, there's a few. I wouldn't go quite that far. But for the most part, I think they're very sane, rational, kind people.
Does that remind you of sanity? Insanity as sanity.
Right. Everything is flipped upside down.
Yep. And you know about that movement, right? In revolutionary psychotherapy. Okay. Around the same time, moving from the we generation to the me generation. Okay. But also notice that she's kind of happily talking about insanity. Food additives. There's a lot of, again, between the lines. Was it food additives? Was it psychedelics? Nah, you know. But it's creative people are a little bit mad. You know?
Well, and what it is, though, is, you know, she goes through all of these things and then dismisses them. But it's really, it's not the one thing. It's all of these things combined.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, again, and it sounds like she's a little bit loopy, too, doesn't it? I mean, yeah. You know, and, you know, it's, you know, we look at this idea, again, it's important to note that this is not happening on one particular nodal point. It's happening on multiple areas, multiple junctures. So it's not just in the media. It's not just mass entertainment. Just going back to the 1930s, how Amos and Andy, this fun show, was pushing the New Deal, creating worker solidarity in conjunction with, you know, direct overt political programming. Artie Lang, The Divide itself, right, is normalizing schizophrenia. At the same time, this drug culture is being pushed. And then as the society begins to change, the drugs start to change. Is it by accident suddenly you have heroin and speed coming in? Is that an accident? You have Kent State. You have all these, traumas. And then, but again, it's not just one juncture. It's not just one cultural nodal point. But, you know, it's things become normalized, just as in, you know, in our society, certain types of sexual practices, even incest, are slowly being normalized. Same thing, analogous way, insanity is being normalized. All right.
Kinsey's pedophilia, etc.
Yeah. All right, so let's continue here. And this one I want you to take, listen to very carefully. I think this is one of the best clips that I have.
All right.
Managing editor of Radio and Records magazine.
You know, we make a statement, we call this concept radio, and everybody has a different idea of what that means. I mean, radio is nothing more than a form of technology. Now, the thing that most of the people who are in radio really are doing is a thing called radio programming. Now, there's a big difference between radio and radio programming. Now, most of the top 40 stations were the result of extreme, careful radio programming. The radio is just the technology through which this programming is brought to you. Now, some people will go into radio and try to see how they lend themselves to somebody's radio programming. Other people, and I am of that school, think of themselves as being the program and looking at radio technology, the vehicle, to bring it to them.
Welcome back, my friends.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty much, notice the influence. Radio is a technology which is a means of programming.
Right, which means that you are the one being programmed, not the radio, which doesn't have any ability for a program like a computer. You know, it's just a transmission device, literally, and has no memory or anything. So therefore, the radio is just the medium to get the message to the target, as in we, the people.
And he says that top 40 radio is the result of extensive programming.
Right.
He's not talking
going
about
back to Casey Kasem, et cetera.
But no, not even that. He's talking about the result of the result of societal programming. So if you go a little bit under the surface,
right,
he's basically saying, I myself am the program and radio is the means. I am the program. What does that mean? I am the program. Actually, I am the programmer. So He's saying that this technological means is simply a medium of deployment of this programming or cultural transformation, which is being inflicted or being absorbed by mass parts of the culture. I mean, and so like you said, top 40 radio is not just because they're playing the songs. It's that it took a lot of cultural programming to make that happen. So he's, you know what I mean? So he's looking from the top vantage point down on the audience, right? And so he's, if you look at his, the way he articulates and posits that, I think that is pretty much directly in your face that this was a means of deploying and allowing this. Do you look at a computer network, this social network being activated and being deployed as a programming of an entire society? And I think he's, that's pretty much a direct admission of that. I like that stuff. So keep going here. Some songs, like even Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, which right after this clip he plays, you know, "Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Come inside," right? This spectacle, like Guy Debord talks about the society, the spectacle, where in a sense, art has eaten life. You know, the fantasy world and the real world are merged, and you can no longer distinguish between reality and fantasy. So
life is mimicking art instead of art mimicking life.
Yeah. Yeah. And so anyways, let's move on here.
Dangerous for anyone involved with a free form approach to anything.
And we're pioneers again. And that's the frontier, if you will, you know, is dealing with each other and dealing with, I find it among our generation, I find a very little regard for the nation concept particularly. There's a juxtaposition of the arts and the body politic, is that the gay action and women's rights and stuff like that, that was it, right? And against the very stubborn resistance of the powers that be, the economic ruling class of this country, these people were carrying out the anti-war demonstrating practices that we put together in the 60s, you know. They were carrying them out, you know, for these other things, and that was all that was going on, you know, and a lot of it got kind of silly, you know, and there's no reason to cop out to the crazies, you know. And they always thought we were the crazies, you know. But we, you know, people like me and Grace Slick and Jerry Garcia and Dylan, I mean, we knew that we weren't crazy, you know. And Pete Seeger, you know, and we knew we weren't crazy. A little eccentric, but not crazy, man. Not on the bottom line, I mean, eyes open, you know, really just, you know, got our perspectives, trying to keep our perspective as together as we could, you know.
The anti-war practices that we put together, right? Anyways, you can pull that apart a little more, but this idea of being pioneers, again, this madness, sanity, we got David Crosby, but this important to note that they do kind of admit, we put this together. We helped create these, we put these practices together, right? We helped create these movements. It's being used for other things. As I mentioned, FM, this sort of network technology, so to speak, psychological technology being deployed in green revolutions, color revolutions, you know, regime destabilization all over the world. It's right in your face today. And again, that network-centered warfare article, even though it says that this is a new thing, I think that we can find it here in the FM radio. I don't know if you want to comment on that clip or not.
Nah.
Okay, let me just play. This is Tom the Snake. It's kind of a little bit fun stuff on talking about the Grateful Dead and stuff like that. So I think there's some nice tidbits in here too. Let me go ahead and play this.
Again, Tom the Snake O'Hare,
who, having been program director at such stations as WQIV in New York and KSAN and KMET in California, has seen FM radio from all sides of the country, much in the same way as the snake talks about the truth.
The truth is too hot. The truth is too hot.
1978? Whose judgment is this?
Well, I mean, you know, there's the great one of the Grateful Dead live broadcast. Now, you've got to feature that the Grateful Dead, for a period of time, did Winterland as a tradition on New Year's Eve. And it was always Terror City that you would go down to Winterland and have to broadcast, because KSAN would, of course, be expected to do it live, and did. You would be the anchor person on this broadcast because you knew, number one, the Dead, that was their night to play, and they usually did till the sun came up. And if you cut off Dark Star after it had been on for 3.5 hours, because everybody on stage had fallen over, it's 5:15 in the morning, you'd get phone calls and letters, and it was very definitely unhip to do. So it was kind of a trial by attrition, because there were things there that would damage your mental perceptive powers.
Okay, next part of that.
Damage your mental perceptive powers.
From year to year, passed from survivor to survivor. Don't drink the punch. Look out for the salami roll. I mean, it was every year it was guaranteed. This is where the LSD is in the, it's in the Jell-O mold. I mean, there were a lot of guys there that, I mean, you would go into Winterland, it would look like, up in the balcony, it looked like a scuba diving school. There'd be so many tanks, guys with masks on. I don't know what they're doing up there practicing. But there were a lot of things that could warp your perceptibility, right? And there was always the Grateful Dead sound crew who was experimenting with their mind-expanding capabilities while they were experimenting with the Grateful Dead sound system. All of this tied in to your live broadcast.
But you start out, the truth is hot. You don't want the truth. The truth is too hot to touch. But then he alludes to the fact that this will seriously damage your mental perspective capabilities. And then he's talking about, again, the sound crew experimenting on the minds. So I, not to put words in his mouth, but in a certain way, he's kind of indirectly referencing the fact that what was going on here was maybe something a little bit more than one would see on the surface of your, you know, happy hippie adventure.
Absolutely. Let's see, we have one more here.
Yeah. Do one more. You want to say anything about that? Or?
Oh, you know, I mean, it's pretty clear. I don't know that I could add anything to it.
Tom the Snake. All right.
Form of thematic musical sets.
So this culture on the street, in musicians, in radio, generally you're considered pretty uncool if you were looking to get into the draft.
Of course.
So
everybody was evading it as much as they possibly could.
Or speaking out against it.
Right. Yeah, right.
Now, when you would speak out against this in a musical term, give me an example.
All right. This was also a folk era. We were emerging from a... the folk people were very, very much on top of it. There were a lot of great folk... The Joan Baez is okay, fine.
Bob Dylan's,
etc. We're saying it for us musically. So you could put together a whole bunch of things based upon an anti-war theme, if you want. And you let the music speak for yourself, and you did not have to make the statement. You know, I'm a get it. The music had said it for you. You opened up with Country Joe. You went into a Dylan thing, doing an anti-war thing. You went into Saigon Bride by Joan Baez. You know, the songs were very prevalent in those days. And there were a lot, we were getting a lot more out of the folk people insofar as the anti-war thing than we were getting out of the rock people.
Okay. The reason I put that clip in there, he's talking about you're conveying a message through the music, right? So you have this drug message. You have these other types of messages.
You never had to say it directly what you were trying to accomplish, because the music, the message was in the music already for you.
Exactly. And again, going back to Amos and Andy, you see that people, they get a message covertly through the entertainment, through, you know what I mean, through this radio programming. And then once that's been inculcated, then it can be stated overtly. right? But first, that's inculcated subconsciously. And you can talk about the drug references that start showing up in so many songs, right? There's so many, even in the folk era, right? You start having these drug references that are coming up in the songs. Was it a common practice to write all these? Why were all these songs about drugs coming out? You know what I mean? I mean, there's so many examples. The Animals, you know, the girl from Sandoz, or whatever, you know. So this, you know, this stuff was, and this relates on a whole range of areas, but we can go further on that. But I think that hopefully, without me necessarily articulating every point, I think that some of these direct quotes from people that were there at the time, the people that helped do it, will tie in with what I talked about earlier, which we discussed, to say that this is not just, the people to a certain extent knew what they were doing or were participating in and they believed in it. But the fact was that this was a developed system that was known to be successful in terms Absolutely. Of changing people's minds. So,
or changing their perception of reality might be more accurately put.
Yeah, no, exactly. And hey, I'm going to go put on my virtual reality headset. I don't, you know, that's kind of the ultimate stage of that.
Yeah.
But Jan, do you know anything about the Grateful Dead, like the sound and light show, the people that were behind that? Have you?
Well, I know that Owsley Stanley was who created, my audio is cutting out there, stepping on the cord, is who created the Grateful Dead sound system. Of course he was the big LSD producer being funded by going back again to the Hitchcock family or the Mellon family, Mellon Banking Empire, Billy Mellon Hitchcock and, Billy Mellon Hitchcock LSD Enterprises. And they were, funneling money, through the Grateful Dead, through, the Brotherhood of Eternal Love out here in Southern California, et cetera. But, I don't know specifics about, the other half of that.
Yeah. Well, there's some interesting stuff that, goes back to the Princeton Radio Project where they had this theater, and working on kind of light shows, sound shows, and this is back in the 40s. And some of this technology showing up in, 60s psychedelic light shows. And there was research done on the effects of different types of sound systems, on the effects of different, types of lighting and all this stuff, even, strobe lighting.
Absolutely.
And all this stuff. And of course, we have the use of types of the dream machine,
Well, fortunately, Roni Gissen Stanley lives in Woodstock, New York, and she is the former, or the widow of Owsley Bear Stanley. So I don't know, I might try to see if I can get a few minutes with her to discuss about her ex or her dead husband's work with the intelligence community and helping to create all of this.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's, maybe she's friendly. She'll give you some tea. You might never come down.
Yeah. Oh boy.
That would be kind of funny if you got dosed up.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be funny if you were dosed, but it would be ironic. That's
indeed.
That happened to a lot of people, as we know. So,
indeed. Well, anything else you want to add to this part two?
No, I think that I think we covered quite a bit, and I think that hopefully when we continue on a little bit more of a zoom in close up of some of the actual operators and stuff like that, we'll get some more understanding. But yeah, it's been really interesting to go through this material, and just wish everyone a beautiful day, and I hope you gain something from this that will assist you in understanding.
Broaden your understanding.
Expand your mind. Expand your consciousness.
Well, like in a real way, and not just like taking LSD and navel gazing and thinking you've accomplished something.
Exactly.
So. All right, Hans. Well, that's a wrap for the Secret History of FM Radio Part 2. And we'll talk to you soon for Part 3.
All right.